Welcome back to the Groundless Ground podcast, the leading edge of mental health. I'm your host, Lisa Dale Miller. Remember, you can now subscribe to and download the Groundless Ground on your favorite podcast app or listen on YouTube, Spotify, and TuneIn. My guest today is Jose Calderon Abo, MD. A native of Mexico City, Dr. Calderon resides and practices in New Orleans, Louisiana. He is board certified in psychiatry and addiction medicine with an additional certification in mind-body medicine. In addition to private practice, Dr. Calderon has served as assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at LSU School of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry, and Tulane University, Department of Psychiatry. He is also national faculty for the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in Washington, D.C. Dr. Calderon hosts Whole Body Mental Health Radio and is an active member of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. He has just embarked on a major career in transition, closing his private practice to serve as medical director of behavioral health for Louisiana with Optum United Health Group. Jose, thank you for being on the Groundless Ground podcast. This is such an honor.
Lisa, I am thrilled to be speaking with you. It's so wonderful to talk and be on your show.
You are such an interesting clinician. You've had so many rare experiences as a psychiatrist that many clinicians never have. Being of service during a major disaster that occurred right in your hometown during Hurricane Katrina. You are now in the midst of what I would say a big professional transition.
Yes.
And I know you've only had a few weeks in your new position as medical director. Might be too soon for you to say the big differences that you've noticed from what you were doing before. How is your life change settling with you?
Well, that's a great question. I've gone through several transitions in my life, and I think we all do. When I was doing psychodynamic training, I was a patient myself in psychoanalysis, and I think I was looking at life transitions through migration, and I was looking at how I had smaller migrations growing up from our nuclear family, and then we transitioned to adolescent. I transitioned from my social group into a whole different area of Mexico City, which is a huge place, and through medical school, and then went and lived somewhere else. So all of these transitions were small migrations that led to the larger one, moving from Mexico City, coming and training in the United States, and now residing here. I've been here a little bit over 20 years. So those are life transitions. Then moved again into New Orleans, and then Katrina hit. Then I had kids, got married, had kids, another transition, and now into this position. You know, I was listening to Ram Dass's documentary, Fierce Grace, and he was talking about many reincarnations within our lives. And so I consider that this is another reincarnation, unlike other ones that were created by catastrophe and a disaster like Katrina, or sometimes for some people have been illnesses and losses. These are positive transitions. Nonetheless, it's stressful. But I have to say there's a little bit different now. So I feel the stress in the transition. I am very optimistic and very enthusiastic about the change and very enthusiastic about learning. It's been stressful the month prior to the transition, and since I've been in this new position, started feeling a little bit more irritated with things, smaller things, more reactive. I've had chronic problems with insomnia, but so those will flare up. The mind wanted to get distracted, so perhaps have a drink. And I was aware that this was going on. However, one key difference that mindfulness and meditation and Buddhist practice have done is that I think there was a clear distinction between feeling stressed and feeling threatened. Thinking at some point about what is stress and what is suffering. Although I've been feeling stressed and enthusiastic and happy about the transition and free in so many ways, and I'll tell you more about it in a moment, I also never felt threatened during Katrina, not so much. I mean, physically not. I mean, there were other threats that were felt. This time has been, I guess, a much lighter transition in that regard.
I want to thank you so much. I don't know about you, but often people I work with tend to idealize me and think that I am not a human being somehow, and I don't go through all the rest of the stuff that they go through. I so appreciate how you just put your humanness right out there. The first impression people will have of you is, oh, he's one of us.
Yes.
And yet,
yes.
Also at the same time, what you did was you mentioned this set of skills and tools and knowledge and awarenesses you've been spending your life as a physician and a psychiatrist delivering to the very people that you work with, and now applying them to your own period of transition.
Once I start seeing the patterns, I think in the past, for example, when I moved to the US and I looking back in other transitions, I would get paranoid, I guess, a little bit. And that's natural, right? I think the mind goes to a default mode of wanting to be cautious in a new environment. So I would tend to get mistrusting of the environment, mistrusting of people's intentions, not knowing how to read that. And I would go by default into this kind of defensive mode and caution. And that's one thing that I don't think I've had, or maybe peaks in here and there. I don't take it as seriously anymore. And I think that's, again, speaking of the practice and having seen this over and over again, you know, it still shows up, but it doesn't have a handle. It doesn't take me into behavioral expressions of that thought. That's been something that I've noticed this time. And that's thanks to the practice, the meditation practice and mindfulness. And the other thing is, I think life transitions are wonderful opportunities to be resettled, like whether we like it or not, into beginner's mind.
Most people have no idea what we mean when we refer to beginner's mind.
To me, what it means is that we are much more present with things, paying attention, knowing it's a very humbling experience. One is almost like an ongoing 24/7 learner of something that's developing and unfolding right in front of the moment. One is forced to be very present, as opposed to be to habitual mode. The brain begins to kind of be economizing one's energy, starts cutting corners and starts paying less attention and developing less energy on attention and concentration, kind of an automatic pilot. We become reactive to things, not knowing why that happened, etc. We do them the same way. But we lose that kind of freshness and newness. That's one of the positive things that come from a transition. So I'm still in the honeymoon of beginner's mind.
You almost pointed out the difference between hypervigilance, which is that threat state, and interest. They both are a use of the portals of the five senses, as well as what in Buddhist psychology we call the sense base of mind.
Yes.
The mind and then the contents that come and go through mind, which are thoughts and emotions. I like people to recall, because we're modern people, so we forget. We are tribal animals. So I imagine when you left Mexico City and you came to America, it's like leaving your tribe in a way. So why wouldn't you be more hypervigilant? You're trying to get to know this group of people who are not your tribe and find your way in.
Yes. I think you're making a great point, Lisa, in this distinction of between both are, I guess, very mindful state. One is based out of fear, real or imaginary, right? The hypervigilance on this and triggers the amygdala, the limbic system, fear-based systems of the brain. And the other one is not. At least my experience of the other one is more of trusting and connecting and engaging with the world in a very different way. I guess it has a much more levity in the heart, but I'm also at the same time, I'm finding myself enthusiastic and humbled and engaging with things and trusting.
Is the medical system you're now involved with requiring you to see patients along with being medical director, or are you just an administrator?
I am not required to see patients. I am continuing to see a handful of patients that are on special treatments that need more careful attention. As you know, there's a shortage of providers, and for those patients, it would have been very, very hard to find providers that can prescribe Suboxone and medication-assisted treatments for addictions. What I started to do is to switch also to do groups right now and continue the human contact and the clinical contact, mind-body skills groups for relapse prevention for addictions, mindfulness groups, meditation groups.
My sense is, as medical director, your integrative point of view, you might actually have a bully pulpit to invite clinicians to investigate a more integrative point of view.
Yes, that's the hope of the position. That's part of the expectation. It has three goals right now. One is the integration of behavioral health with primary care and medical health. So integrating, again, the heart, mind, and what happens from the neck up, the neck down. That's where the country is going, and that's where you start seeing the attempts all over the country to do this, you know, at a public health level. It's on everyone's minds is the substance use and the opioid epidemic. And the third aspect was to bring forward mind-body preventive, innovative approaches to improve their health. I'll tell you, for one of the things that came up recently was a conversation about thinking integratively. We also need to take care of the healthcare provider. You know, there, as you know, there's a great deal of attrition and burnout, which also puts patients at risk and increases ill outcome, reduces the quality of care, and becomes a medical legal liability. Also, it's associated with mismanagement of resources. For all reasons, I think if we're talking about a system of care and healthcare, we need to be talking integratively at the provider level.
I absolutely agree. I have a nephew who is in his third year of medical school right now. It just boggles my mind how little has changed. Residents are still being treated terribly. Even though Yes. we talk about physician burnout, they're still doing Yes. 80-hour weeks. I know this is a big topic right now, physician burnout, and trying Yes. very much to help physicians and nurses and other allied care providers to have a better quality of work. And yet, you can just see that even at the get-go, they're not allowing residents and med students to come into some different point of view about this.
Mm-hmm. There have been some changes in the number of hours that a resident can be on after being on call, for example, but still there's a long way to go. It's very interesting because I'm seeing now that the entire system, obviously, it's set up not only on the educational side, but also on the reward side to be a model that based on quantity and not necessarily on quality. At least one of the major aspects of being in this position with this organization is that there's a greater appreciation for quality and shifting the system in a way that rewards quality care and more integrative care. And I was lucky that this organization appreciates and is looking for that.
Well, you touched on the opiate epidemic. Any chance Yes. you'd like to spend a couple of minutes sharing your thoughts on the front lines, what you're seeing in your area?
All of us have seen this, and we're going to spend an hour talking right now, for example. By the end of this hour, four people will die from an overdose.
So can we just take a moment?
Yeah.
I really want you to say that slowly so people can actually wrap their mind around what you just said.
There are four people right now. Their life is coming to a crossroad in which they're going to die from an accidental overdose in the next hour, 8 or 9 in 2 hours. And off you go to about 60 plus in any given day in the United States.
How many of those have started their opiate use either after a surgery or after a dental procedure? And not necessarily because one day they woke up and said, I think I want to try Oxy.
About a third, 40% of patients in my practice, or those that I have access to, that was the route in which they came to their addiction, you know, the prescription of something. Now, there were other confluent factors at the time in their lives. You know, there was the opiate effect on the pain system being so much linked with the stress system. So whenever there's stress and emotional pain, and there was a significant emotional pain aspect for them, the pain medication, the opiate medication, took care of the physical pain, but for them also took care of that emotional pain that they had. So that's a large segment of these folks that were more at risk, develop an addiction to them. There's the other population of people that I saw mostly at university hospital, people that had multiple comorbidities, tremendous pain and suffering, PTSD and trauma. And they came to opiates as a long line of other substances. Started with smoking marijuana and cigarettes and drinking. And then they moved on to other things and they landed on an opiate. They were so accessible. And I think all of them, I think what they do have in common, a significant number of them came from prescription opiates. The massive quantities of prescription opiates and the diversion of them that are on the streets. The cheap heroin and other opiate derivatives, fentanyl and norfentanyl, that are coming through Mexico and China, that just created the perfect storm.
Mental health, particularly addiction treatment, has been separated from medical treatment for so long that I think Yes. a lot of what could have been prevented if we thought of trauma, mental illness, as we think of cancer and heart disease, this may not have spiraled out the way it did, because people Yes. might actually have been able to get the right kind of treatment when they go to their primary care physician.
You know, my colleague, she was on the podcast, on the Whole Body Mental Health podcast, talking about her book. I think she put in a very complex problem in very simple ways. Her name is Anna Lemke, and she has her book called Drug Dealer MD. And in the book and in the conversations that we had, she was able to mention that not only was the lack of integration that was happening, but also many things were shifting. Here's where I think the Buddhist psychology comes to mind. We want quick fixes for things, and we're more reactive to things and the unpleasant things. And there's a very short tolerance to discomfort and to pain, physical pain, emotional pain, etc. We get caught up with them. We don't see the transition, that these are transient states, that they're impermanent, that they are not threatening. You know, there's pain and there's suffering, as we were talking about this. People started demanding quick fixes for things. We think that we need to have access to anything. It's our God-given right to do that, right? And that we need to find the closest to happiness in that way. Another aspect of capitalism going awry, pharmaceutical industries pushing prescription opiates, and then all of a sudden funding medical associations to change the way in which we were using prescription opiates. In the 1990s, when I came to do my residency in the United States, this was already shifting. Pain became the fifth vital sign. We had to monitor that, or else the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals and Medicare, Medicaid Services will ding the hospital for not doing pain assessments. Where I was training as a medical student in the course of 4 years, this shifted. For example, I was taught that to assess pain, one can ask the patient, but also we need to look for objective signs and symptoms of pain and then treat the pain accordingly. And that shifted. When I took my boards for psychiatry and took them to the United States, the new Kool-Aid was that we had to ask the patient and take that at face value. And that was it. There was no more question asked. If the patient said they were at high pain, then we were prescribing to address that pain. And all that brought in the course of 20 years in the making into the current crisis. I would say that there's socioeconomic disparity and emotional pain, devastation of communities that happened economically, etc. This is not going to be a solution that would come out of, again, a pill or psychosocial interventions only. This is the entire society. We have to look ourselves at the mirror and see what we can do to help each other out as a society.
Just like in the 1990s, when pain was becoming the new barometer, there appears to be some starting of recognition that the neighborhood you grow up in, the family system you grow up in, these are determinants. And this American idea that somehow you pick yourself up by the bootstraps, you make your life be exactly what you want it to be. That is an actual possibility for every single one of us. And yet, there are certain things that happen for us chronically over and over and over again that create a nervous system, a mind, a body, and a psyche that may in fact have a tremendous amount of difficulty navigating that kind of heroism.
Yes.
The opiate epidemic, the fact that it started in rural America, where America really started dying first, which it did.
Yes.
They were the canary in the coal mine between meth and opiates in rural America, and the fact that simultaneously many mental health professionals and physicians didn't really want to practice in rural America anymore. So the level of healthcare delivery was quite low.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So you've seen all this in New Orleans.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the socioeconomic disparity, the access. There's also a laissez-faire attitude about substance use, and particularly alcohol, but other substances too. And you're mentioning, interesting, the community. So not only the genes, combination of nature and nurture and neighborhood.
You recently wrote this incredible blog post about a gift that you gave yourself as part of your transition from your private practice now into being medical director. Is there any chance you'd like to share with the listeners about this incredible journey?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yes. So this actually triggered the transition. I think that the rumbles of the transition were already in the making, the desire to learn something. You know, in the last couple of years, I was thinking, I want to learn something new. And I was invited last year to go over the summer to hike the Grand Canyon, and an extreme hike that is not recommended to be done in the same day. It's called the Rim to Rim hike. Go from north to south or south to north rim on the same day, which is 25 miles. You go 7 miles down, you go 7 miles up. It usually takes about 14 to 16 hours. So it's one of those that you prepare for that is not recommended unless you have to be in shape and prepared for this mentally. Like a marathon, for those of you that run marathons and do other things, is 50% or more mental preparation. We did this, and then we had a couple of mishaps while this was happening there, and that upped the ante a little bit for the level of stress. We had to get creative a little bit and had to come together as a team. So when I came out and, you know, started all these ideas of the experience, and so I wrote about those from a Buddhist and psychological perspective. If you're interested, it's on mindfulpsychiatry.com. So when we came out of a very difficult situation into the North Rim, it took us 18 hours. And we came out at 10:30 at night and cold, and I was pretty shaken by the experience. The next day, as I was kind of a little more relaxing in the North Rim Lodge and kind of was licking my wounds at the moment, I called my wife and she said, I'm sorry to say this, but you know, this is the day where Hurricane Harvey was bearing on Houston. And she said, we're in such a precarious situation in New Orleans. This is the third major coastal city that gets hit with a major hurricane, and it's only a matter of time for many of us here. So New Orleans, over in Miami, Houston, that helped put things in perspective between the impermanence and how resilient life can be, my physical body and mental, etc., but also how precarious it can be to that fine line. And things can change quickly, very fast, in an environment that can turn hostile to life very easy. I think that just called for me to look at what was worth, to take action, to say, you know, I want to change things. And that is what really made the change. Fast forward, I'm in this position 3 weeks in, and that had all to do with the Grand Canyon walk.
When we allow ourselves to do something at the extreme end of what we think our capacities are.
Yeah, so, and that also was a test ground to see, you know, all of the skills that you and I teach people and practice ourselves. Sometimes they were helpful, sometimes they were not. So I wrote about all that to help others mostly. It's not a story about me, but a story about mind and a relationship. I think at the time I was also beginning to dive a little bit more deeply into the aspect of climate change.
So you mentioned climate change, and you are involved in the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. And I think it's important for people to know that many mental health professionals have banded together in various organizations. I belong to two of them, to begin to deal with the ramifications of the trauma that people are experiencing now and will experience probably a lot more as climate disruption becomes more and more of a reality in people's actual day-to-day lives.
Yes. How are you involved?
5 years ago, an organization was started called the RTRC. I don't know if you know Lisa Van Susteren.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
She and Bob Dopelt, who is up in Oregon, they and a couple of other people came together and they said, you know, we're delivering trauma skills to people, but we don't really have a way to deliver them to the communities that are actually most impacted by climate disruption, which ends up being the communities that do not have a lot of wealth. They decided it might be nice to create an organization whose mission is to try to come up with sets of skills that are very easy to impart that anyone can use to deal with nervous system dysregulation, to deal with some of the mental agitation that goes along with not knowing, but also being directly impacted by disaster. And the organization is growing. We've had two conferences, one last year in DC, one that just happened in Oakland, California. I'd love for you to say more about what Climate Psychiatry Alliance does. I want people to understand this in a very specific context. We are not questioning whether climate change exists.
Right.
That is not happening in any of these organizations. We are going on the assumption that comes from science. It's real, and people are being impacted negatively. And it's our job to be able to help people to understand those impacts and have more awareness about what's happening.
You're absolutely right. It's not a political issue to discuss whether this is happening or not, or what's causing what. This is a scientific issue, not a political issue. And I do think it's a health and mental health and spiritual health. We're on this together, and it's not going in the right direction. And you mentioned trauma. So I think from the mental health perspective, we often tend to think about the aspects of trauma that you all had in California with the fires and the disruption of community that's happening, the loss of life, but also the disruption of communities, the fear, then the economic impact. So these are situations that carry on, right? It's not just some scary event. It just carries on and people are still not back in their houses, or perhaps they had to relocate some other place. So we're not only talking about the aspect of the trauma, but also of the aspect of resilience. And also, how do we work with the denial of climate change, whether it's for political reasons or economic reasons, or just simply because it's just so huge that we just don't know how to begin to address it. we're in the perfect position as healthcare providers and mental health care providers to help people change their ways.
I wish we could come together and do the same thing around gun violence.
These three issues, on denial of climate change for economic reasons, the gun violence aspect and slavery, those three were morally incorrect and they were on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of humanity. They were morally and ethically incorrect.
So interesting how Western psychology has tended to not really tackle societal ethics.
How do you mean?
Personality and behavior and the way one thinks. These somehow have not really been put up to ethical scrutiny. Everything is pathologized. Nothing is really questioned in terms of basic human values.
Yeah, it's almost delegated to philosophy or some other aspect, right?
When I was educated in my graduate program in psychology and counseling, there was a large emphasis on you're not in the room. So whatever it is you're thinking, you mm-hmm. can't be applying your set of beliefs and ethics to what's coming up in your patient. And yet there's great wisdom to this, obviously, otherwise you'd just be a narcissistic clinician. But on the other hand, sure. if you have someone you're interacting with and you can see that there's a point of view there that is so steeped in some kind of distorted way of thinking or feeling, and that's causing them and the people around them so much suffering, to not be able yes. to deliver a wisdom point of view so that yes. they can begin to inquire, maybe offer something that they can chew on that might allow them to yes. have some kind of shift. It's a dialectic method, a Buddhist yes. analytical method
yes.
that appears to have been lacking in mm-hmm. Western psychology. I'm not sure if you agree with me.
I think I do, and I understand what you're saying. Let me see if I understand this correctly, because we've focused on the medical model of disease. It's about reduction of symptoms, depression, anxiety, and behavior, certainly. But when we talk in psychodynamic psychiatry, the reduction of symptoms through the workings of the subconscious, transference, control transference. But when you bring the heart-mind practices into practice, it's really coming to our true nature. And our true nature is an ethical nature. First and foremost is to do no harm. That requires inquiry whether we're behaving in a line with our core and true values. Those come into play more and more if you're using heart-mind practices. In a secular medical model, there's some ethical as to how we need to behave as practitioners, but it doesn't come in a therapeutic way in the therapy session in relation to the patient.
I also think in our profession, there appears to have been an emphasis on top-down, trying to manage everything that's coming up from the level of thought.
Mm.
Do you have a specialty in mind-body medicine? Maybe share about your experiences of introducing the patients that you work with to modalities that stimulate or enliven wellness or well-being that's innate in the organism and not necessarily something we're putting into people.
Even Freud talked about the ego and his famous line, the first and foremost ego is a body ego. The wisdom of the body. If everything begins in the mind, how we think will change how we feel, change how we behave. And then the next cognitive revolution, the most modern one that incorporates mindfulness, is not only changing how we feel, think is not really about that. It's really changing the relationship of thoughts. So they become less important in driving our behavior. Core beliefs begin to come to the forefront, but also taking refuge in the body. The more we spend there, the less we're spending in the cinema of thought. Reducing that reactivity that we have in stressful emotions and situations by coming to take refuge into the body over and over again. Also to realize that the body is not a tool only to do things, to see that the body is a place of refuge, and that the body is actually a composite of many things and is a point of interdependence in so many ways with everything. Even our gene pool is not just our gene pool and that there's cells from our mothers that are floating around and moving around. It's a composite. Brings the question of who are we and what are our true desires?
I think people have a tendency to take some internal narrative script and say, this is mm-hmm. what my life is supposed to be about and this is who I am. And most of yeah. the time, that script is missing the connectedness that comes from actually being a part of the world you're already in. You don't yes. have to invent the world. It's already here and your yes. body's already in it. Why not go join the body where it already is?
Yes. So
I generally work with people that have a very hard relationship with their body. Their bodies yes. have betrayed them
yes.
with autoimmune disorders and other things. So many people that I work with say, I don't want to be on medication.
Yes, yes. Thank you. That's a very good question, particularly integrative psychiatry, mental health, and even people that are not looking for alternatives to offer that there are other ways of doing this. Medications are very helpful to make immediate change. There's nothing more robust than a medication, the way they act in the brain. But I think that depends on the people. You know, if depression is so severe, they can't even engage in a meaningful discussion of what's happening in their lives, or trying to sit and meditate, completely ravaged by negative self-deprecating thoughts, or somebody that's suicidal. So there are extreme versions of this in which medication would be life-saving and is necessary and indicated for a number of people, and I think that most of them would be a transition where they would take medication as a scaffolding while we work on other things, on nutrition, physical activity, relationships are the very foundationals of our mental and physical well-being, relationships, sleep, nutrition, physical activity. Also, I add at that point, the next level is to start doing activities that are much more in line with our hearts. You know, that's where I think the ethical aspect comes into us. Meaningful activities in relationship to others involve helping others in some way, being engaged in the community. While that takes place, medication can be in the background. And then there's a number of people, and I would say the minority of people in Western medicine, we say that they have severe mental illness in which medication is indicated all the time, much like insulin would be indicated for diabetes. You know, so for those people, medication is indicated and it's very imperfect, but the alternative is much worse.
Yeah.
So that's my take in relationship to medication.
I think it's really important for people to understand that some of the tools are getting better. There's DNA testing to see which class of medication might actually work.
Yeah, so it's going in that direction. Genetic testing, we can have more targeted interventions too as well, more personalized interventions for people in regards to the medication.
Do you know whether or not there are less medical students choosing to go into psychiatry?
No, I think there are more. There's an increase in students that are going to psychiatry. And also students that are going to dermatology, ophthalmology. I think you see people understanding that what they want to be physicians, life work balance is important to them, and that they don't want to work the 14-hour shifts that sometimes surgery or OBGYN will call for it. And have been interested in integrative approaches to this, and that, you know, mindfulness is all over the place. Most major medical schools will have a small interest group of students that are into holistic care, mindfulness, and mind-body medicine. Yeah, but I must say that as residency trainings, what is less is residency trainings that are shifting to have a more integrative approach to this, that is not just biomedical, medication-driven, that they see the importance of psychotherapy, but even more than that, to get out of our head and into our body. What do we eat? How do we move? And we spend more time with the body as opposed to just be mentalizing all the time.
Hear, hear.
Yes. But there's hope. It's moving.
Is there anything we haven't talked about?
Two things. I think it's coming full circle to where we started, the new position where I'm at United Healthcare in Optum. I feel tremendous privilege of working with individual people. It's an honor to be on people's life present at the moment in which there's happiness and difficult and accompanying them through this journey. But I also felt there were two things, and I think going back to this Grand Canyon and what was percolating in the last several years since Katrina, since the fires and before that for you guys in California, the droughts in the United States, the floods in other places, and what's happening everywhere. I think there are two forces that are going to drive healthcare in the future. One is climate change, for sure. And the other one is socioeconomic disparity. We need to do something about this too, because it's completely interconnected. We talked about the opioid epidemic being so much related to the pain and suffering of the socioeconomic disparity in some of those areas that you very wisely mentioned that started in rural America. Those two are the major threats that are coming to our societies, to our democracy, and to our physical well-being. I needed to take another stand and make a change a little bit to see if I can have a greater impact from a different position that is not just individual one-on-one care. We can all be part of the solution, get involved in something meaningful. For some people, meaningful maybe in relationship to reducing socioeconomic disparities, to address climate change. Sometimes they're in our face or not. We want to be in denial of them, but there are many things that we can do. So that's where I'll be spending my hours of insomnia. That's what wakes me up at night, these two things, socioeconomic disparity and climate change.
as a clinician, I would recommend you appreciate the position you put yourself in during the daytime, how much influence you can have, and don't think about this at night when you're trying to sleep.
Right, the mind. So the mind, right? The old friend mind. I'm trying.
I think Optum and United Healthcare are very fortunate to have you. This has just been so incredible. I hope you'll come back. I'm sure after a while of what you're doing that you may have a lot to share about what medicine looks like from the other side.
Thank you. I think we're, you know, part of the same body, right? Just doing different functions, but we're all interrelated. We're all humans trying to make this a better place. There are points of convergence when we can have very good quality of care and we have accessibility of care, and that is cost effective. So we're not in this dualistic, polarized view. It's the healthcare management organization versus the patient versus the provider, et cetera. We're all trying to do this in different ways. We have different experiences. We can bring different things to the table. I'll check in with you. I would love to come back if you invite me and we can talk more about how that's going.
Well, you're invited. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. The Groundless Ground podcast is now available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. To find out more about this episode, see a list of upcoming guests, or get in touch, visit groundlessground.com. Now let's dedicate our efforts to the healing of our planet and all its inhabitants. See you next time on the Groundless Ground.